The superstar Ethan Blake died before I was born. But I knew about him. I knew so much about him that I idolized his entire life. I was just a kid when I was introduced to the glamorous, carefree, and all the other liberties of life a superstar like Ethan Blake could afford. It was like watching a movie, only that my mother would squeal a reminder every other minute that it was all real. It is easy to understand how Ethan Blake became my idol if you understood how much my mother lived for him. He had been everything to her in her younger years. He had appeal like no one else in his era did, and would sell out records on the same day as he released them. His fans, fanatic to the point of frenzied participation, just like my mother, were all over the world. From America to Australia, Africa, Europe, and Asia. A true global phenomena that many knew and loved. I suspect the love was so intense for Ethan Blake because these people had seen themselves in him. He had maintained an aura that had pulled them in and made them a part of his world. In a way, they felt they were him. Tragic things happen when a star drifts too close to the sun. The gods become jealous and snatch the light from its core. It was what happened with Ethan Blake. He died in a plane crash during a sold-out tour in Asia. My mother talks about it with such a somber air as the Pope would talk about the death of Christ. Every bit of joy sucked from her face, and the atmosphere would turn tense as she narrated the moment. Occasionally, she would drop her face into her palm to grieve him. I had gone through tapes of the incident myself, and I had just seen the same reaction from people when they found out he had died in a plane crash. Now, even though I was born years after he died, I was just as intrigued by the life that he lived, and the way that he chose to live it, that I did what many most have thought of, but none before me had done. Or maybe my mother did it first, because she named me Ethan Blake, just like the pop idol that so many people admired. But, to mark the 30th occasion of his death, I underwent a surgical operation to bear his looks. I was a college grad at the time, and I had all of the hours in a day to think of an execution, whatever thought it was that had come up in my head. The Ethan Blake operation was one of my better ideas. My mom had been pleased with the outcome of the surgery, and she had even burst into tears when she saw me, telling me just how much like Ethan Blake she thought I looked. It was the highlight of that surgery. Sheer horror awaited me weeks after I had the surgery. The thrill had subsided after a while, and I had gotten used to being identified in public by people way older than me as Ethan Blake. It was not unusual that they would walk up to me and try to touch my face to see if I was real. But the worst incident was on that lonely, dreadful night. The bustle of the road had been buried by a passing storm that had made the roads wet, leaving a slippery, vacant expanse of travel road for me on my way home. I had driven home with this innocence of mind and no expectations of drama. I had just turned into the driveway and put my car into park when I noticed her in my back seat. I was beyond mortified by her horrible look. Her skin was as pale as the moon in a stark, dreary night. Her eyes carried the shadows of her forehead, sunken holes on her face that provided no windows into her soul. Her lips were chapped, dried by the elements, and her hair appeared to have been messed with during the episode of a fight. Her cold demeanor filled the car, and I noticed that the reason that I had just seen her when I was in my driveway was because she had been laying down the entire time. My lips trembled, as did my hands. The air between us was fragile, tossed about with deliberate care so that neither of us could break it without the other's consent. The rear-view mirror was our means of communication. "Who the hell are you, and what are you doing in my car?" I turned around and barked at her. She covered the space between us quickly, as though she had been waiting on me to make my first move. My heart beating in my chest echoed in my ears. She placed a finger on my lip, and her face was mere inches from mine. It felt like a fever dream had caused me to fall into her hypnotizing, terrifying blue eyes. She smelled musky, like old perfume, rich, but pungent from containment. Her lips moved as though she were speaking not to me, but at me. I folded my fist into a ball and ready to strike, but her eyes caught on to my action. Her face did not alter from the emotionless expression when she spoke. "You killed him, Ethan, after all he did for you," she said, and I noticed that she was struggling with tears. I was puzzled. I hadn't killed anybody. As I stared into her eyes and lost myself in the grief-stricken motion of her pupils, I had a sense I was in danger. But she was quicker. She retrieved a knife and stabbed it towards my neck to finish me off. I threw my hands up instinctively, and the blade ate into my arm. I cried in pain and tried to escape. She stabbed me again, and this time the blade sunk into my torso. I was out of the car in a hurry. "You took his song and made a name for yourself! A superstar off the song Larry wrote for you, and you gave him nothing!" I heard her cry as she pursued after me. "He killed himself because his sweet heart could not bear such betrayal!" She pursued me and jumped on me with her knife to stab me. I caught her hands and hollered back at her that I was not Ethan Blake, even though I shared the face and the name of the 80s pop star. I was chilled to my bones when she said she knew, and I was her only chance at retribution at the man who hurt her. At once, I recognized the look in her eyes, and I registered that they were glazed with madness. My heart was beating too fast from the terror of her satisfaction of having a chance to hack me to death. I was losing blood, and I knew it was a matter of time before she finished me off if I did not resist her. We struggled for control for a good period. Her frustration grew quickly, and the knife slipped into my hands. I grabbed it and turned it into her chest, lodging it for a whole minute until her body went limp. A neighbor found our bodies on the ground of my driveway, as I would find out from the doctor. The crazy would-be killer had died, and I was barely alive from such a horrifying experience.
Last month, I was supposed to go camping with my cousin Frank, but I'd gotten into a fight with my girlfriend Trudy, and I had to cancel on him. I expected him to reschedule for the next weekend, but instead, he decided to go alone. I tried to tell him that it was a bad idea. He didn't know the area as well as I did, but he wouldn't listen. I think he was mad at me for bailing on him, especially because he never liked Trudy at all. So he left Saturday morning, and I was hoping to hear from him when he got there, but he never texted. I tried calling him a couple times, but he didn't respond. I thought that maybe he couldn't get reception up in the mountains, but I knew that wasn't true. I'd been up there plenty of times before, and I'd always been able to make calls. By Sunday, I was getting pretty nervous. I called the police to report him missing, but when I explained everything, they told me that I was being paranoid, because I mentioned the argument that we had beforehand. They just assumed that Frank didn't want to answer my calls. Frustrated, I decided to drive up to the campgrounds myself and try to find him. I didn't tell anyone where I was going. I parked near the ranger station and saw a couple of other cars in the lot. I was about to head up the trail when I realized that one of the cars was familiar. It was Trudy's. Why was my girlfriend's car here? Confused, I decided to call her. She answered immediately. "Trudy, where are you right now?" "On a walk," she said. Clearly, she was hiding something from me. "Hey, do you know where Frank is? Your cousin? No?" Then I heard a noise in the background. "Sorry, gotta go." And she hung up on me. I went into the ranger station to see if anyone had seen Frank or Trudy, but the place was empty. Just in case, I left a note and then headed back to the trail. The campgrounds were pretty big, so I wasn't sure I was going in the right direction, but I kept walking. I passed a few empty cabins and a small stream. I recognized the area well enough, so I knew I wasn't going to get lost. I continued towards the area where Frank and I had gone camping before, and sure enough, I saw his tent, backpack, and a pair of sneakers. I knew this was his stuff because he decorated his backpack with stickers from his favorite rock bands. He wasn't there, though. I went through his backpack just in case, but it was mostly empty. Just a few packages of chips and water. By then, I was really nervous. I searched around their campsite and I couldn't find anything. Just in case, I called Frank again. This time, I heard his phone ringing in the distance. Filled with hope, I raced towards the sound. I ended up in a patch of forest that I'd never seen before. The ringing stopped. I started to call him again when someone walked out of the woods. It wasn't Frank. It was Trudy. "What are you doing here?" I asked her. She took a deep breath and then explained that she'd come here to see Frank. She admitted that she was s***ing with him since last month, ever since we'd started fighting. "You cheated on me? With Frank?" I asked. She nodded. But he felt really guilty about it, so he left me last night. I haven't seen him since, and I think he got lost. She held up the phone in her hands. He left his phone behind, too. I couldn't tell if she was lying to me. I always assumed that she and Frank hated each other, but maybe that was just an act. "Why didn't you tell me this when I called you?" "Because I was ashamed. I'm so sorry." I was angry, of course, but mostly I was scared. Even though Frank betrayed me, I didn't want anything bad to happen to him. "I've been looking for him all morning," Trudy added. "Do you want me to help?" "Okay, fine." Together, we continued walking through the forest. She pointed towards all the areas that she already looked. I followed her lead. She took me deeper and deeper into the forest. We didn't say much to each other. Eventually, we made it to a cliff overlooking the valley. If Frank had walked here at night, he might have fallen over the edge. I was filled with dread. Trudy reached the cliff first. She looked over the edge and gasped. "Oh no!" I joined her. Looking down, I saw Frank's body lying dead on the ground. Trudy started to cry. "This is all my fault. I should have stopped him. He said he was going back to his car, but I guess he got turned around." Something wasn't making sense. I couldn't put my finger on it at first, but then I looked closer at Frank's body. "You said he was trying to get back to his car?" "Yeah." "Then why is he not wearing any shoes?" Trudy started to smile. "Because I lied. I threw him down there." "What?" Before I could react, she grabbed my arms and started shoving me towards the cliff. She was still smiling. I'm bigger and stronger than Judy, but she'd taken me by surprise. Before I knew it, she had me hanging over the edge. I couldn't stop her. "Why?" I yelled. "Steve, I think we should see other people." Then she threw me off the cliff. I remember falling all the way down, but I don't remember landing. I guess I passed out from the pain. I don't know how long I was unconscious, but eventually I was able to open my eyes. Both my legs were throbbing in pain, obviously broken. The side of my face was scratched and bleeding, but I was alive. I turned my head and saw Frank's body just a few feet away. He wasn't so lucky. His head was twisted unnaturally to the side. With effort, I pulled out my phone and dialed 911. I ended up talking to the same dispatcher who talked to me before.
"Remember me? The guy you said was being paranoid? Well, my cousin's dead, and I'm badly hurt."
I told her my location and she contacted the Rangers. I'm at the hospital now, with casts on both my legs. The doctor said I'm most likely going to make a full recovery. The police are still looking for Trudy. When they do, I'll finally find out why she snapped. I hadn't seen my older brother Alan in a couple of years, but I knew that he'd changed a lot. We used to be really close, but ever since he moved to Nebraska, he started to pull away from me. He got pretty religious, and whenever we'd talk on the phone, he always added judgmental comments about my lifestyle. I'd been happily divorced since 2022. My ex-husband was a total loser, and I'm so much better off without him. But Alan did not approve. He'd never been married, so he didn't understand how a marriage like mine could just fall apart. I hated how he lectured me about that kind of stuff. So over time, I just stopped answering his calls. Last month, he called me out of the blue to invite me over. He said that he missed me, and he didn't understand how we drifted so far apart. But he didn't apologize for all the times that he offended me. I really wanted to see him again, and although that if we had an actual face-to-face conversation, maybe we'd actually hash things out. So I agreed to go. I flew to Nebraska, and he picked me up at the airport. I stayed at his house for a day before he started lecturing me again. Having that conversation in person only made things worse. I stormed off and checked into a nearby hotel. I went online and changed my plane ticket to leave in the morning. I was so angry that I traveled all this way for nothing. I sat by myself in the hotel room, waiting for Alan to call and apologize. Of course, he didn't. To help calm me down, I went to a hotel jacuzzi. I saw one of the other guests, a pretty blonde named Jane. Right away, she seemed really friendly. She said she was a long-term resident of the hotel. She didn't tell me she was a but I figured that she was. I was a pretty hardcore feminist, so I had nothing against her line of work. If she was happy with her life, who was I to judge? We stayed in the jacuzzi for about an hour. I told her about my problems with my brother, and she assured me that he'd come around. She told me about how her family had disowned her before they eventually reconnected, and that gave me hope. Just when I was about to go back to my room, I heard a buzzing noise from my purse. Someone was trying to call me. I got out of the jacuzzi and saw that it was Alan. I answered the call, but I accidentally left it on speaker so Jane could hear both sides of the conversation. Alan asked me if I'd calmed down enough to go back. He said that he forgave me for overreacting. I felt like screaming at him, but Jane waved at me from the jacuzzi. "Call him Mr. Golden," she whispered to me. I didn't know what she meant, but I did. I called Alan by that nickname, whatever it meant, and then Alan instantly went silent. "What's wrong?" I asked him. He absolutely freaked out, screaming into the phone that I had no idea what I was talking about. Then he hung up on me. Jane smiled and explained that she recognized Alan's voice. He was one of her clients, and he'd use that nickname whenever he saw her. Apparently, he paid for Jane's services dozens of times in the last year. I couldn't stop myself from laughing. My brother was such a hypocrite. I felt so vindicated by exposing him. I thanked Jane for the tip and went back to my room to dry off and watch TV. I guess I fell asleep pretty fast. Eventually, I woke up to a desperate pounding on my hotel door room. A little groggy, I went to the door and looked through the keyhole. I didn't see anyone on the other side. A little scared, I opened the door and looked outside. The corridor was empty. I told myself that I probably just dreamt the noise. But then, I noticed a bloody handprint on my door. Chills ran up my spine. Suddenly, I saw some movement around the corner. I slowly walked outside, ready to run back in my room if things got dangerous. That's when I saw my brother standing over Jane's dying body. She had a knife to her stomach. I stood there, frozen. I just caught my brother murdering someone. He turned towards me and said, "She swore she'd never tell." My whole body was numb. I felt myself backing away. He just stared at me for a long moment, deciding what he should do next.
Then he reached down and pulled the knife. In a rush of movement, he raced towards me with the knife. He was going to murder me too. I was his sister. We were so close. But now it was like he was a completely different person. I ran to my open door, but Alan grabbed me by the arm and pulled me towards him. He held the knife to the side of my neck. "Sinners need to die," he whispered in my ear. I felt the cold edge of the blade pressed into my skin. If I didn't fight back, he'd slit my throat. I elbowed him hard in the stomach, forcing him to loosen his grip on my arm. I raced down the corridor, jumping over Jane's dying body. Alan wasn't too far behind me. He was extremely fast, diving at me with the knife extended. But just as he leaped over Jane's body, she stretched out her hand and grabbed his ankle. Instantly, he toppled forward and landed face first on the concrete. He laid there for a second, not moving. I couldn't see the knife. Suddenly, I reached down and pushed Alan's body to the side. The knife was sticking out of his chest. He had accidentally skewered himself when he fell. His eyes had rolled back to the back of his head. He was dead. I went back to my hotel room and grabbed my phone to call the police. When the ambulance came, they took away the bodies. I went with them to the hospital. Alan was declared dead, but the doctors said that Jane would make a full recovery. We still keep in touch.
The clatter of rain against the windows mirrored the storm brewing within me. I stared at the insurance cancellation notice on the table, the bold red letters shouting at me like an accusation. In 2 days, our coverage would lapse, and it wasn't the only bill we were behind on. The root of it all sat in the driveway. Those damn car rims, shining like the silver bullet to our financial stability. My husband Mark had a knack for turning small disagreements into monumental disasters. We'd been scraping by, both working fewer hours than usual, and yet he insisted on those rims. I'd told him no, explained the consequences, but he had his way of justifying things until they seemed like necessities. "You just don't understand," he'd said, almost pleading, the night before he went through with the purchase. "It's not just about the rims. It's about feeling good, having something to show for ourselves." "And what about our bills, Mark? What about our insurance?" I'd retorted, my voice rising with frustration. "We can't afford this." He'd nodded, seemingly agreeing, but his eyes had already glazed over, his mind miles away from our conversation. 2 days later, the rims were on the car, glistening like trophies. Now, I was left with the aftermath. It was late at night, and I was still wide awake, anxiety gnawing at my insides. Mark was snoring softly beside me, oblivious to the turmoil he'd caused. I couldn't just sit by and watch our life crumble. The stress was eating me alive, and I needed a way out, a solution. I slipped out of bed and made my way to the kitchen, where the soft hum of the refrigerator provided a semblance of normalcy. My eyes landed on a stack of bills, and an idea began to form. What if there was a way to fix everything? A way to turn our situation around? The thought was both thrilling and terrifying. The next morning, I confronted Mark with a plan. "I've been thinking," I said over breakfast, my voice carefully controlled. "We need to make some changes. I found a couple of freelance gigs online that could help us catch up on the bills. But you need to sell those rims." He looked at me, his expression hardening. "Come on, Lisa. We talked about this. They're not just rims. They're an investment." "No, Mark," I said firmly. "They're a luxury we can't afford. We're drowning in debt, and if we don't do something, we're going to lose more than just our insurance." He didn't respond, just picked up his coffee and walked out the door. I knew he wouldn't listen, but I had to try. That night, I waited until he was asleep before I took action. I found the contact information of a pawn shop in a rough part of town, one that wouldn't ask too many questions. The next day, while Mark was at work, I drove to the shop with the rims in the trunk. The man behind the counter gave me a suspicious look but offered a fair price. It wasn't enough to cover all our bills, but it was a start. When Mark came home and saw the car without its precious rims, he exploded.
"What the hell, Lisa? Where are my rims?"
"I sold them," I said quietly. "We needed the money."
"You had no right,"
he shouted, his face turning red.
"Those were mine!"
"No, Mark, they were ours. And they were ruining us." I stood my ground, meeting his furious gaze. He stormed out, slamming the door behind him. I didn't know where he went, but I didn't care. For once, I felt like I was in control. Days passed, and Mark barely spoke to me. The tension was palpable, but I focused on the freelance work, slowly chipping away at our debts. One night, while I was working late, I heard a noise outside. I peered through the window and saw Mark talking to a man I didn't recognize. They were standing next to the car, and I felt a chill run down my spine. The next morning, the car was gone. Mark didn't come home that night, and I couldn't reach him on his phone. Panic set in, but I tried to stay calm. I called the police and reported the car stolen, but without much hope. I had a sinking feeling that Mark was involved. A week later, I got a call from the police. They'd found the car abandoned in a bad part of town, stripped of everything valuable. They also found Mark, or what was left of him. The officer's voice was grim as he explained that Mark had been involved in something dangerous, likely trying to get back the money for the rims. He'd crossed the wrong people, and it had cost him his life. The funeral was a blur. I felt numb, unable to process the whirlwind of events. Our friends and family offered condolences, but I could see the judgment in their eyes. They didn't understand the hell we'd been through, the choices that led us here. In the weeks that followed, I found myself alone in our house, haunted by memories. I couldn't escape the guilt, the feeling that I'd somehow caused this. But as I sorted through Mark's things, I discovered something that changed everything. Hidden in the back of his closet was a small black notebook. Inside, I found pages of scribbled notes, detailing Mark's secret life. He'd been involved in illegal activities for months, trying to make quick money. The rims had just been the tip of the iceberg. As I read through the notebook, a disturbing pattern emerged. Mark had been manipulated, coerced into making bad decisions by people who preyed on his weaknesses. He'd been desperate, and they'd taken advantage of that. But among the chaos, there was a glimmer of hope. I found a letter addressed to me, written in Mark's shaky handwriting. In it, he apologized for everything, admitting his mistakes and expressing his love for me. He explained that he'd been trying to make things right, to give us a better life, but he'd gotten in too deep. The letter ended with a plea for forgiveness and a promise that he'd try to leave something behind for me. Attached was a key and an address. It led me to a small storage unit, where I found a box containing cash. Enough to cover our debts and then some. The relief was overwhelming, but so was the sorrow. Mark had made terrible choices, but in the end, he'd tried to do right by me. I used the money to pay off our bills and started fresh, determined to honor his memory by making better choices. It wasn't easy, but I found a way to move forward. I took on more freelance work, slowly rebuilding my life. The nightmares still came, but with them, a sense of purpose. I'd survived, and I'd make sure that Mark's sacrifice wasn't in vain. In the end, I found peace in the small moments, morning walks in the park, the warmth of a good book, in the quiet comfort of a home free of debt. Mark's ghost lingered, but it no longer haunted me. Instead, it reminded me of the strength I'd found in the face of adversity, the resilience that had carried me through. And as the days turned into months, I realized that I wasn't just surviving, I was living. And that was the greatest victory of all. Over the years, I became more and more self-conscious with my ever-drooping face. With each year that passed by, I noticed my cheeks began to sag more and more. It was my sister that finally convinced me to undergo the knife. My sister was almost unrecognizable after all her plastic surgery. Whenever I asked her what work she had done, I zoned out by the time she reached the end of her list. Despite other people's judgments, my sister was happy and confident with herself. So, I took a page from her book and scheduled an eyebrow lift. I found my doctor online. Dr. Gingham had glowing Yelp reviews. On the day of my consultation, Dr. Gingham looked at me with his gentle eyes and asked what brought me in. He told me I reminded him of his late daughter, Patricia, and how he couldn't imagine I would want any work done. I joked with him that praising me wouldn't be a good way to secure a new client. He gave me a warm smile and continued about how I reminded him of his daughter. He explained he lost Patricia 3 years ago when a drunk driver T-boned her going through a light. Dr. Gingham said his daughter was barely recognizable when he identified the body. She was so mangled, he had to check for a tattoo she had on her ribs. He seemed like a caring, compassionate man with extensive experience in plastic surgery. So, I trusted him with my face. The day of the appointment came, and I almost got cold feet and canceled the whole thing. I wish I did. I was uneasy in the office, but my sister assured me it would be fine. "It's just an eyebrow lift," she told me. "I doubt you'll even see a difference when the doctor is done." I changed from my clothes to a hospital dress and waited for the nurses and doctor to begin. They took my vitals and asked me a bunch of questions, and then Dr. Gingham came in and marked my face where the cut would be. He started by marking my chin, and I stopped him. "Why would you make an incision by my chin if we're just doing an eyebrow lift?" Dr. Gingham laughed. "I was just testing you." He winked at me, but my uneasiness didn't fade. I forced a chuckle to make it seem like it was okay. He took his pen up to my eyes and made a few marks. "Okay, are you ready?" he asked me. I nodded. One of his nurses came up and instructed me to count back from 10. I started. 10, 9, 8, 7, and everything went black. When I woke up, I was in a bed much more comfortable than the one I fell asleep on. I looked around, but it didn't look or smell like a hospital. It smelled like freshly baked cookies and looked like a teenager's bedroom. My face felt tight, and I tried to lift my hands to touch my face, but I was restrained to the bed. I tried to yell for help, but the bandages muffled any noise I strained to make. Suddenly, an older woman peered around the corner of the open door. We made eye contact, and I tried to ask for help. She checked her surroundings before creeping into the room. "Patricia?" she said. I shook my head. "My sweet Patricia." I guess she didn't see me shake my head no. "Honey!" Dr. Gingham rushed into the room and escorted the old woman out. On their way to the door, I heard him say, "She's not ready for you, my darling." It was a while before Dr. Gingham came back. He sat on the edge of my bed, which made me uncomfortable. I tried to push him off, but he didn't budge. He looked at me with those kind eyes, but I wondered if they were a true reflection of him. "I was so happy when you came into my office. You just looked so much like her. Just a few tweaks needed to happen before you could really be her." Dr. Gingham caressed my face. I flinched away. "Sorry about her. She's just excited to have her daughter back." This is when I started to panic. I was tied to a bed with bandages covering my face to the point that I couldn't speak. I started pulling at the restraints. "Now, honey," Dr. Gingham embraced me. I yelled as loud as I could, but the bandages muffled everything. "You're confused," Dr. Gingham smiled at me. "Sorry, this must all be very confusing. After all, you fall asleep in one room and wake up in another. Let me explain. My wife, who you just met, has dementia. It got worse after our daughter died. With losing my daughter and essentially losing my wife all in one go, I have fantasized that someone would walk into my office and just need a few adjustments to replace my daughter. I thought maybe not only could I get Patricia back, but maybe it would also help my wife's condition." My heart pounded against my chest. "When I saw you,
I knew you were the one. You only needed a nose job, some work on your chin, and an eyebrow lift to become Patricia's twin. We did the chin work, so I still need to do two more operations before you're complete. You can assimilate into my family once all the surgeries are done. Since I couldn't speak, I couldn't even ask him what his plan was if I didn't agree to assimilate into his family. We're going to do the surgeries over the next couple of days, so for now, rest. He took a syringe and injected something into my arm that made me feel very drowsy. The room went black again. I woke up again, and Dr. Gingham was in the room with another lady. I tried to make eye contact with her, praying she would see the desperation in my eyes and help, except the nurse never looked at me. Dr. Gingham turned to me. Only one more to go. Do you want to watch some movies while you rest up for the second one? No, I wanted to tell him. I want to go home. He smiled at me one more time before he left. I had to come up with a plan to get out of here. I couldn't see a way to avoid the third surgery, so I decided I had to wait. After the surgery, I would pretend to sleep longer so they wouldn't keep giving me whatever medicine made me drowsy. I would regain my strength, escape restraints, and run like hell. Dr. Gingham finally made an appearance after a couple of days passed. In the meantime, I tried to figure out how to get out of the restraints. "Ready for your final surgery?" Dr. Gingham said excitedly. I shook my head and he laughed as if I was telling a joke. "You have the same sense of humor as Patricia. I'm so happy you walked into my office." He gave me an earnest smile before injecting the drowsy liquid into my arm. When I woke up this time, I kept my eyes closed. I could hear them buzzing around me, but I remained still. "She should have woken up by now," Dr. Gingham said. I heard the steady beep of the heart monitor as he and his nurse left the room. I waited until I felt fully conscious before starting to act. I began to pull my right hand to try and wiggle it out of the cuff. I knew the only way would be to break my hand. Through my nose, I sucked in a big breath and pulled my arm hard. There was a sharp pain in my thumb joint, but I kept pulling until my hand was out. With my good fingers, I started to undo the restraints. When I stood up, the room started to spin. I considered getting back in bed and waiting a little bit longer. But what if they found out I got out of the restraints? I peered around the corner, and it looked like I was in a house. I stayed close to the wall as I crept down the hall towards the stairs. At the bottom of the stairs was the front door. Relief washed over me, just seeing the exit. No one was around, so I sprinted towards the door. I opened it and felt the cool air on my face. In nothing but a hospital gown, I ran as fast as I could down the road until I could flag a car down. A woman was in the car.
"Are you okay? Do you need help?"
"Help," I tried to say through the bandages. Luckily, she could make out what I was saying and drove me to the nearest hospital. She waited with me and called the cops. When the cops finally came, they took the bandages off, and I was finally able to speak. I explained everything to them and finally got in contact with my family. After some investigating, they couldn't press charges because Dr. Gingham had no record of me coming into his office. I asked them to check the security footage, and according to Gingham's office, the security footage from that day glitched, and they didn't have any. The cops admitted it was suspicious, but they couldn't charge him for anything since they had no hard evidence. When I finally looked in the mirror at my new face, part of me wished I could have kept the bandages on forever. What looked back at me wasn't my face, but a stranger I had to live with forever. The night was dark, and the streets were deserted as I pulled up to the traffic light, waiting for the light to change. My mind was occupied with thoughts of the long workday, barely noticing the figure approaching my car window.
"Excuse me, sir, spare some change?"
The voice was almost a whisper, but it jolted me out of my reverie. I turned to see a disheveled man, his eyes pleading as he extended a weathered hand. Instinctively, I reached for my wallet, ready to offer some assistance,
but as I padded around to figure out which pocket my wallet was in, I felt a pang of unease. I was barely able to pay my bills, and I had just checked my bank account to make sure I had enough to buy toilet paper. On top of that, there was something about this situation and the panhandler that didn't sit right with me. "I'm sorry, I don't have any cash on me," I said, my voice faltering slightly. The man's eyes narrowed, his expression darkened. "Come on, man, just a few bucks, I'm desperate here," he pleaded, his tone growing more insistent. Before I could respond, the light changed, and I hastily rolled up my window, eager to escape the uncomfortable encounter. I mouthed sorry to him as I turned left into the Walmart parking lot. As I drove away, I couldn't shake the feeling of eyes boring into the back of my head. I pulled into a parking spot and got out of my car. The lights in the parking lot flickered. I was still thinking of that weathered man. I felt bad I couldn't give him anything, but times were tough. I was only at Walmart to get toilet paper, but I also grabbed a $5 bath bomb for my wife. I couldn't afford flowers, but she would love a bath bomb just as much. Before I headed to the checkout, I got a text from my wife. "Can you grab a pizza or lasagna for dinner? It was a long day and I don't want to cook." I responded, "For you, anything. Any particular pizza sound good?" She told me to get whatever I wanted because she only cared about having an easy dinner. I strolled over to the frozen pizza aisle and assessed all my options. Was I in a thick or thin crust mood? What toppings? I took my time deciding before I landed on a boring pepperoni pizza. I headed to the self-checkout, swiped my card, and headed back out to my car. The closer I got to the car, the stronger the smell of cigarettes became. I looked around to see if someone was smoking, but I was the only one in the parking lot. When I reached my car, there was a foul stench. It smelled dirty. Again, I looked around to see where the smell came from, but I was the only one in the parking lot. I threw the toilet paper in the trunk and approached the door. When I opened it, I realized I had forgotten to lock it. My mind was so wrapped up thinking about the panhandler, I forgot to hit the lock button. My heart skipped a beat, but relief washed over me when I remembered that I had nothing of value in my car. So, there was nothing someone would want to steal. I got in my car, and the foul odor increased tenfold. "Jesus Christ," I said out loud. I plugged my nose and held my breath. "I should have gotten car fresheners." I rolled the windows down on my way home, which helped, but I still held my breath at intervals. When I pulled into the garage, all the lights in my home were on. My wife beat me home. I crawled out of my car and got the toilet paper from the back and went inside. My wife was drinking a cup of wine, waiting for me. She greeted me with a smile. "What kind of pizza did you get?" I showed her the pepperoni pizza. "Can't go wrong with pepperoni," she said. "That's what I thought," I responded. "And one more thing." I pulled out the bath bomb and her face lit up. She ran over to me but recoiled. "What is that smell?" she asked. "Did you smoke a cigarette?" "No, but I think someone was smoking one when I left Walmart." "I don't mean to be mean, but can you change and take a quick shower? You reek. I can get the pizza started." I obliged. As we ate, she told me all about this one troubled coworker she has who never does any work. I love her, but she can ramble. She went on, and my mind wandered back to the panhandler. I'm unsure why the thought wandered into my head, but I wondered how long it would have taken him to walk to the Walmart parking lot. Could he have been the source of the smell? Did he rummage through my car to see if there was anything to steal? Except my car didn't look like anyone had gone through it. I thought of that old urban legend about a villain sneaking into the back of an unsuspecting individual's car. When the person leaves and when they're far enough away, the villain reveals himself and kills the driver. Could the panhandler have snuck into my car to hitch a ride home? I told my wife my thought process, and she thought maybe I should take an anxiety pill. It sounded like my mind was running wild with these thoughts. That story is just an urban legend. Still, I checked my car. I drive an SUV, so he could have sat all the way in the back and I wouldn't have seen him. I went out to my car, and the garage was filled with that nasty odor. I plugged my nose and inspected my car. No one was in it. With that, my wife and I went to bed. Later that night, the same stench crawled back up my nose while I slept. When I woke, I felt like I was in a cloud of that smell, which also woke my wife up.
"What is that? Did a pipe break?"
my wife inquired. I heard something shuffle by her closet. I squinted my eyes to try and make out what was in the dark, and I saw a figure. It was like a night terror where a shadowy silhouette was coming towards you, but you couldn't move or scream. But this shadow remained where it was. Dread filled my body. My wife grabbed my hand.
"Honey, do you see that?"
She turned on the light. The room illuminated, revealing the panhandler standing by our closet, breathing heavily. His face twisted in a sinister grin.
"Thought you could ignore me, huh?"
he sneered, advancing towards us with a menacing intent. I didn't wait for him to make the first move. Under the bed, I kept a steel baseball bat just in case something like this happens. I jumped out of bed and grabbed it. With a cry of fear and desperation, I swung the bat with all my might. The sound of the metal hitting the panhandler's head echoed through the room. My wife screamed. Like a tree, he fell to the floor. I called the authorities so they would take him away. I wasn't charged for anything on account of self-defense.